Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Long before the Harvey Weinstein allegations blazed across the world, lighting a touch paper to age-old issues of equality and equanimity between the sexes, today's guest's cutting-edge work in learning was venturing beyond institutional approaches to effectively address long-standing issues between women and men, girls and boys. Dr. Zeus Yamayanis is a counsellor, psychology professor, philosopher of education, and author on Spiritually Confident Living. He teaches people to apply emotional and spiritual wisdom, especially in the areas of personal and organisational performance, gender, self-esteem, and relationships. He joins me now to discuss his new book, The Spiritually Confident Man, Pioneering a New Frontier of Co-creative Masculinity, in which he addresses what it means to be a vital man in a world of change, in which old definitions of masculinity have collapsed, as well as what is needed mentally, emotionally, and spiritually for men to answer the increasingly urgent challenge of transformation. Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. Appreciate you having me here.
Toxic masculinity, abused and fearful women, power, dominance and patriarchy. They're just a few of the words that have been prevalent over the past 8 months or more. Some might think that your book, The Spiritually Confident Man, was inspired by those headlines. But if I'm not mistaken, you were writing it long before the Weinstein story broke. So tell me, what was your motivation for writing it?
I think my motivation at base, and I think this has a lot to do with my dharma, my sort of calling in the world, arose in my own childhood around the notion that this sensitive, special, what I call divine genius that everybody has, men and women, you know, boys and girls, filtered through these amazing inflections and prisms of our ethnicity and gender and so forth as a beautiful thing, didn't seem to get recognized as a positive thing, if recognized at all. And furthermore, that when people do express the sensitive spiritual kind of uniqueness through the prism of their individual being, they seem to get attacked. And one of the main reinforcers of that attack is what feminists call patriarchy. It's what I call in my book. It's defined as rule by men, but it's actually a ruling mentality, and that women can be patriarchs and men can be anti-patriarchal. But it's basically a mentality of what I call the ruler on the throne versus the provider of the feast. That is a person who has a certain kind of resentment or fear or insecurity in this world is the ruler on the throne and tries to do something to subdue or control the world. And this is taken largely the form of a gender war between men over women. And I'm interested in a world in which the provider of the feast or this divine genius is expressed and exchanged in very vivid ways. And I think I've always felt that from a very early age, even, you know, stemming from a lot of it stemming from a near death experience I had when I almost drowned when I was 3 and a half, just feeling this intense sense of all the possibility that gets lost when people try to attack or control each other, and a lifelong journey to try to find a positive, powerful expression of an alternative to that.
So you start the book by saying that for the first 50 years of your life, you were misplaced. Is it because of that experience that you had?
I think so. I think that largely I thought I had this kind of inrush of insight during that experience where I just could feel my own and other spiritual genius, the something that is, you know, ready to come into blossom into this world. It's already present. in its spiritual form. And I think being misplaced had to do with me trying to fit it into the forms of the world rather than doing the opposite, which I finally begun to break through here after the first 50 years of life, which is to say, no, wait a minute, this world itself is an expression of that spirit. Instead of trying to fit them into institutionalized forms, and instead of just trying to take, as important as it is, you know, political or economic or so forth approaches to oppression, let's go from the other side, which is to fully foster a breaking out of this spiritual joy and talent amid this other stuff, and lift the world's frequencies to help meet the spirit, the same spirit from which this world itself came. And I think that that kind of shift is the thing that got me from a misplaced man to one in which I'm like, okay, instead of trying all the time to cram this vast, vast spirit into these small forms of the world, many of them dominated by mentalities like patriarchy, meant to actually reject the spirit or to control it, to break out of that mentality and say, wait a minute, there can be a certain grace here, a certain powerful blossoming, a certain powerful kind of empowerment that can come by simply recognizing I am made of this spiritual energy. It's inflected through this powerful prism of gender or masculinity, this polarity of masculinity, and it can be a great aid to the world instead of a great curse to the world. And the only turn I really need to know to make is to say, is to offer that generously as a provider of the feast, rather than to force it in an insecure way from the ruler on the throne mentality. And that to me is that kind of dynamic started quite a long time ago, but it took a while for it to come to fruition.
So that's why you say that patriarchy does not benefit men, that the cost on them is far worse than any political, material or economic gain that they can get. They are losing a fundamental part of themselves.
Absolutely. If you take out your spirit and sell it for anything, I mean, you know, there are quotes in the Bible and all kinds of things that says, you know, he who sold his soul, you know, what does it profit a person to sell their soul and gain the world? It's a really bad trade. And the same is true with males and patriarchy. Some feminist, more materialist feminist analysis has gotten this a little bit wrong, because they have said, you know, that men, quote unquote, benefit from patriarchy. This is not true. The costs of patriarchy to men, their spiritual character, to their emotions, to their mental functioning and well-being, are so much greater than any possible gain, that you can see this in the way that men operate, who've been, quote unquote, successful in this patriarchal world. You get the intense sense of how insecure they are, how much they're trying to prove themselves. Well, you wouldn't need to do that if you were piled high with benefits. you only do that from a situation of debt. So basically, you sell your spiritual birthright in exchange for essentially a counterfeit notions of success and power that never produce the kind of security, assurance, creativity, and well-being that really being close to the spirit, close to your intuition, close to inspiration provide for you. But here's where the feminist analysis is right on. And here I have to say that men, and the way that men have been indoctrinated or initiated into this world, strongly, strongly even encourages good men with good souls to, at the most, just stand by and watch other men do this. You know, if men do not challenge other men to be higher men in this more spiritual provider of the feast sense, then they are agreeing to their own debasement. And that's where the feminist analysis is right on. It's like, when are men going to show up and step up in terms of this, you know, and not just, you know, have little sensitivity training seminars, but to really begin to engage the feminine in a not just a respectful way from a behavior standpoint, but from a wondering and fascinated way from the male perspective that creates a nice complementary energy in exchange with their own energy, where the women are not seen as simply mysterious or simply as eye rolling kind of, oh, she wants this, that kind of thing, or as problems to be solved, as I said in one of my other interviews, but rather as, you know, sources of inspiration, of hope, of an intriguing challenge, not not again in the way of trying to figure something out, but as a way to get into a spontaneous dance, a co-creative dance, where that feminine energy and the masculine energy meet each other, and some interesting new thing is formed as a result of that.
You did your thesis on self-esteem, and I have to wonder, reading your book and hearing you speak, whether you have long felt that self-esteem is one of those weird things that everybody appears to have it, but nobody really does. Is that true? And do you think this is particularly true of men, that there is a false front, if you like, of manhood that they feel they have to meet, and that in its behind that lies this lack of self-esteem, because they're being inauthentic?
Absolutely. By being initiated into a world in which your worth is contingent upon a certain kind of demonstration of worldly activity, whatever it happens to be, economic success or, you know, some kind of sexual virility, or in terms of sleeping around, other really misbegotten notions. And this is what causes the attractions of pornography and other kinds of things. It's this sort of objective and objectifying sense of power in the world. When that's it's not only extraordinarily lowly, it's extraordinarily disempowering and productive of insecurity in a man. Because if you adopt that framework, then nothing is ever going to be good enough. You could have $30 billion and you will still be insecure. You need to go for $40 billion. You could be sleeping with 10 different women, but that's going to be too little, you know, because you could always have more, and your worth is consistently and constantly be built upon enlarging yourself and inflating yourself. And that's certainly what I saw in my research. Men are far more likely to inflate themselves, inflate their achievements, in order to gain an alleged self-esteem. And the way that I put it, too, is in the book, I said that men are in, when I looked at self-esteem issue, I found that men's main problem was self-deception, right? The grandiosity they would have. And a lot of times that grandiosity was there to prop up or as a crutch for self-esteem and self-worth. Whereas women, and then as a result of this, if anything came along in which a man had to be self-reflective or take responsibility, he pawned it off on someone else. Because, you know, to actually suggest to himself or reflect upon his being wrong or not doing quite the right thing, that would be such a blow to him. He needed to wall that up, project it on somebody else or something else, and in order to keep his inflation high. Now, with women, it's the opposite. In my research on self-esteem, I found that women's major problem had to do with trust, self-trust. You know, they would tend to take responsibility and problems that they had nothing to do with, and think it's somehow them. And if you look at some of the self-esteem assessments, the whole issue is a little overblown. But what would happen is that when they had comparative questions asking, it's like, I'm as good as most other people, they would tend to have more moderate answers to that because they didn't want to put themselves above others, right? And they sometimes lacked a little bit of this, more this self-trust or the self-regard in terms of being able to toot their own horn. I was listening on to a radio show where the two women were talking about it and how difficult it is for women to sort of brag about themselves. So they actually were forming a club where they would brag about each other because yes. The notion of relationship was important, but the notion of self-promotion was somehow not acceptable, not beautiful, and it came out of this lack of self-trust. Ironically, this has helped women, this lack of self-trust, even though it has some bad sides to it, it has helped women not take themselves for granted, not become entitled, to work hard, as some people have said, to work twice as hard for half the recognition in the workforce. And it has allowed them to actually become quite successful in recent and modern times when it comes to work, when it comes to running families and so forth, because they've been forced through this sense of insecurity from a different realm to compensate by, in many ways, by holding families up and by being the productive backbone to a lot of companies. So, you know, my wish is that women can begin to rely upon men a little bit more to step up, to show up and step up, because I think they're doing a lot of the work of the world right now. And for, and for women to be able to actually relax into a more co-creative relationship with a male where they're being recognized by men explicitly. You know, another typical situation that many of your viewers, men and women alike, will relate to is in any kind of conference of people in a business meeting, a conference room, an academic meeting, it's very common that a woman will bring up a brilliant insight and it will not be recognized simply because it's a woman bringing it up. A guy will repeat, and I've tried this as an experiment, will repeat the exact same words that woman just said, and all of a sudden, bam. Now it's entered into the conversation at the table. It's almost as if people have been trained to kind of elide and push women into the background and overly inflate and draw men, even men who haven't come up with anything original, into the foreground. Now that doesn't benefit either men or women. Women with the original insight ought to be recognized and recognized in their own way. So that's, you know, that's the thing we need to do. And that's the thing that I'm finding that we're still struggling with, because a lot of us accept these sex roles, and we are kind of trying to reach a new platform without recognizing where those feeling, emotional, mental, and spiritual habits that have been kind of tweaked by basically the habits of the world, by the institutions, by things that we have been confronted with over many times by patriarchy over thousands of years. So my book is a way to begin to pull back the layers of that onion and do it in a very non-confrontative way, to say, hey, we all have benefit, men and women, boys and girls, from challenging these and creating these positive co-creative alternatives. And I don't just do them in touchy-feely ways. I actually address issues like abortion or male circumcision, and I address real and practical ways in my book about doing this. But I also take more poetic and metaphysical contextual look at it as well. So I try to combine those two, because I think that's really the way forward for both men and women, boys and girls, is to bring that spiritual, that metaphysical, together with the practical, to be guided by our spiritual, but at the same time to be brought into this opportunity to be, I guess you would say, blossomed on the worldly level. And I think that's the real joy of living. That's where the real beauty is in life.
Agreed. I'm going to hold you there, Zeus. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is psychology professor, counselor, philosopher of education, Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, and we're discussing his new book, The Spiritually Confident Man. Still to come, the three types of manhood, what men think women want, and what spiritually confident masculinity looks like. We'll be back in a few moments. Stay tuned.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Zeus Yamayanis. History books would have us believe that there's been a battle of the sexes since the beginning of time. My observation is that seems to be more true of the West than certainly not indigenous cultures, many of whom seem to have a much different attitude. If this is true, where did it all start?
Well, I think, you know, you can go back and I do address I think I'll use this opportunity to address a small section I did on male circumcision, because I think that it's a great window from a present practice into ways in which we may perpetuate a practice, even a practice that if you looked clearly at it, seems to involve quite a degree of violence against a defenseless individual, and yet the reasoning around it seems to excuse it in some way. I'll just come right out and say it's my personal opinion that male circumcision is, again, is both unnecessary and quite a baptism of pain and violence for a young male boy, for a young male baby, because these are done when babies are days old. The irony about circumcision is that it didn't just start as a Jewish custom. Circumcision has dated back to primitive societies, some of the oldest in the world. The Aboriginal society in Australia is the longest continuous culture. It's over 50,000 years old. And that was, circumcision was demonstrated in that culture as well. There are many theories on why this happened. It was a way to, initiate boys, I guess. It's a way to create kind of authority and to get young men to identify as a tribe. That's what it seemed to be within the Jewish culture, what had to do with that sort of a covenant between Abraham and God. Then the other Abrahamic religions, Christianity, and even the Muslim religion adopted that. Most people don't know that about 80% of Muslim boys are circumcised, which almost seems tremendously ironic and staged, because you have all this battling in the Middle East between Muslim and Jewish and Christian religions, and yet all of them adopted as cultural attributes this notion of being the chosen sort of person, having this special covenant by cutting off a lot of the delicate skin of a few day old baby boy. Now, no one really pretends that this isn't very painful. And all the arguments, the medical arguments about it being hygienic or more helpful, were mainly basically perpetrated in the 19th century as a kind of post hoc rationale for what is, I think, quite a barbaric and unnecessary act. And a lot of it was done to quote unquote dissuade the practice of masturbation. So there was a notion of diminishing male sexual sensitivity as a purposeful act. If you take a lot of the motivations for this, exclusivity of tribe, dominance of males over the younger males, or incorporating them in or putting them in line with patriarchal customs, and even the diminishment of sexual pleasure, you begin to kind of paint a picture of where patriarchy is coming from. And it's a desire to dominate, and it's a desire to dominate and put under the power other people under your power. And there's nothing more traumatic and more direct and more helpless than doing that with a very, very young baby. And we can look at this in terms of cultures. We can look at this in terms of the history of patriarchy, which I do in my book. I have a whole chapter directed toward the patriarchal man in Patriarchy, Chapter 5, in which I show that ancient Near East religions had a more counsel-oriented, what I call Genesis 1-oriented understanding of humanity as coming from spirit, as coming from the same substance as God. Men and women were created equal, both out of the substance of God. You can go right to Genesis 1 and have all that confirmed. And God's saying that both human beings and the world were very good. And then somehow that changed right around, let's say, 3,000 to 5,000 years B.C., up emerged a kind of God to displace this God that was punitive. And the Adam and Eve story sprang from this notion of God. God was punishing us. The original sin rather than original blessing became the new narrative. Some people liken this with this, and Leal was the figure of this kind of God. And Leal is in ancient mythology essentially a punisher God, one of the earliest forms of it in Mesopotamia. And he raped an adolescent girl. I don't think that's a coincidence that is the sort of inception of that God, and that is the way of that God. So you have this lower form of spirituality coming in. If you're more positive, you'd say this lower form is trying to teach us about, you know, through challenge to embrace our higher form and to challenge the lower minds of ourselves, because we as human beings are a combination of the animal and the spiritual. But, you know, the ones who are more, who have a more understanding of the nefariousness of this would say we were infiltrated by a ruling mentality called patriarchy meant to subjugate our spirits to the powers of the world and to do that through the auspices of recruiting men to subjugate each other from birth and circumcision and to subjugate women, after. And it's interesting, just as an added thing, one of the things, reasons given for some of these ancient tribes, these were African tribes, was that cutting off the male foreskin to expose the sensitive part was there to make it look less like a woman's womb, basically, less moist, less hidden.
Right.
So
yeah.
I thought that was very curious.
And female genital mutilation, of course, was for similar reasons also practiced, you know, widely. And that's about subjugation too. Indeed, subjugation is a word that I think runs throughout our history. I mean, if we go back thousands upon thousands of years, you can read reports about us having been a matriarchal society, and we subjugated men. So, you know, the thing is, we cannot allow this to go on happening, you know.
No.
The domination of one gender over another gender.
That's why I'm very, I was going to say, that's why I'm very, very clear. It's in the subtitle of my book, Toward a Co-Creative Masculinity.
Yes.
And this co-creation is absolutely critical. What I also noticed in the 50 years I was being a misplaced man was that all these men's studies, and I studied a lot of the men's studies books like Iron John and so forth, that they had a notion of recovering masculinity that never really explicitly included the wisdom of women. You know, they would go back to their sweat lodges and drum circles. There's these promise keeper guys and some Christian background that would fill these stadiums, you know, literally 50,000 people stadiums with no women. And I'm like, wait a minute here. If we are going to form a strong masculinity, we have to do so in the presence of a strong femininity. With a healthy pole of femininity and a healthy pole of masculinity, and these have to be co-created. So that also was one of those things that are so obvious and yet so missing in our dialogue.
Absolutely. In chapter 2, Examining the Seeds, you write that there are three current versions, three types of masculinity: the animal man, the social man, and the co-creative man. And within those types, there are nine forms or expressions, I would imagine, of manhood. Now, obviously, they take up a significant part of the book. Can you give us a brief overview of those so that we can get a sense of what you're presenting in the book?
Well, the first thing I say there is that these are inherent aspects of masculinity. The first thing I wanted to make clear is that each one of them plays a part and a necessary part. We evolve through them, but we retain them, just like chakras, right? If you move the energy up from the real base sexual chakra of the first into the creative chakra of the second and up to the higher, more refined levels, you still retain those chakras. The lower levels give you desire. They give energy, and prana comes from down there, right?
Yes.
And the same is true in terms of the way I talk about masculinity and sexuality. It's about integrating, not simply leaving behind the so-called lower realms. It's about integrating them, welcoming them into a higher, more, I would say, healthier world. And the same is true with the basic evolutionary path of the man. He goes through different evolutionary stages, but he retains the other stages, but they've been informed, right? They've become evolved in such a way that they find their better expression. The animal man is oftentimes associated with a more traditional conservative man, and it has to do with a kind of charisma, right? A force, a personal, almost animal magnetism. And it is, and it's a thing that gives us desire. It's a thing that sexuality, sexual desire comes from that. The desire for survival comes from that. It's a more base. It's attached there. But a man without that would be kind of what I call a wet noodle. The problem,
yes,
of course, comes when that man is not able to get into a more refined state. The lowest or regressed form of the animal man is the toxic man. That's a guy like Harvey Weinstein, a person who's just kind of run unconsciously. Some might even say our current president, but it run unconsciously by impulses toward power, by impulses toward domination, by getting self-worth out of that. Next, you go from that, and I provide an example for myself of the striving man, right? That's the transitional form of the animal. I'm not just trying to conquest. I'm actually trying to prove something in the world. I'm actually trying to provide some kind of show of strength or talent. But, of course, that's problematic, too, because, again, my worth is always going to be contingent on achievement or accomplishment there. And finally, the advanced form or the evolved form of the animal man is what I call the responsible man. That's the one who's able to be like a good traditional family man, responsible, provide, protect, sacrifice, and serve. But again, that comes at a cost as well. Many of these responsible men are also emotionally stoic. A lot of them die early of heart disease, even in their 60s, because they're taking on so much pressure and there's no place to vent it. And so I say, well, then we progress. That's more the traditional. Now we're progressing to the modern man. You know, these are all, we're all going through this in our individual lives, but it's also kind of historical rendering. Okay. So the regress form of the social man, now the social man is built around belonging and the need for approval. Okay. And ability to be cooperative. So that was basically a reaction to traditional man and some of the abuses and dominance. But sometimes the modern man or the social man has gone too far the other way, becoming a bit of a wet noodle. Like, okay, I'm endlessly amenable. And if that's happened, then his masculine polarity is dissolved. The regressed form of the social man is what I call the retreating man. And this is the one saying, hey, I don't want to be dominant. I don't want to do anything. I'm stepping back from that. And he's just not showing up. A lot of women complain about these guys that they never make a decision. They can't even say when to go out, what restaurant to go out for. They're not stepping up in any form. And again, that was done in reaction to the inappropriate displays of force of the animal man. But, you know, in order to develop strength socially, that person, that man has to progress as well. So the in-between part of that is what I call the confused man. Okay. You know, I'm going to try to show up. I'm going to explore a lot of different options. I'll be kind of a different man in every situation. And I'll appear to be somewhat fickle because I'm trying to find myself, right? I'll try out different relationships. I'm somewhat accepting, but I'm not a terribly reliable person as a confused man. And then the evolved form of that is what I call the equal man. The equal man is what a lot of people see in the sort of enlightened modern man, right? He's an equal partner. He's helping to raise the children, not just helping. He's a co-parent, right? And he's not just helping do the dishes as if somehow it was a magnanimous thing, but he's actually recognizing it's equally his responsibility to do the dishes, you know, and he's able to not be threatened by women and able to get along with them, cooperate with them, and do things with them. And then a lot of people say, a lot of women out there might say, oh, that's good for me. You can stop your evolution right there. I wouldn't mind having one of those guys. There are not enough of those out there. And I would say, well, you know, that's all well and good, but we need to enter more into the spiritual and metaphysical realm. And that's where I talked about the co-creative man, because even in that situation, there isn't that sort of positive mutually empowering spiritual framework. And so that's when I really said, let's go to the top point in the triangle here, which is the co-creative man and co-creative woman as well. And that's the one who's beginning to understand the essence of the spirit as an energy working in the world and feel the polarity of his masculinity, wanting to go beyond his family and community and wanting to accomplish or create something that goes beyond just all the markers of the world, whether they be responsibility, whether they be just, you know, going through family life. And this naturally comes when the kids start to leave the house, because all the focus of the equal man, for the most part, is around family, community, and a lot of times shepherding in an equal way the children into the world. Now what? Okay? And this is what happens. This sense of despair is what happens, and that's the regress form of the co-creative man. I have this despair. Okay, my purposes, men are so geared toward tasks and accomplishments, you know. I've raised a successful family, all these sorts of things. Now what? Here I am, 50 or 60 or whatever, and, you know, I don't know what to do with myself now. And oftentimes, and you can feel my encroaching mortality, certain things are slowing down, and I'm saying, what is it all for? That's the despairing man. And then if you can see this as an opportunity, I have this huge section of the book. I said, when a man ages, this is his time. Instead of the opposite, instead of thinking about lost virility, instead of trying to find a woman half your age and divorce the person that's been loyal to you for your whole life, you can say, listen, I now have an opportunity not to focus so much on the physical, but to focus on the way that the waning of the physical opens up an opportunity for the spiritual. And this is the transitional form of the co-creative man, what I call the searching man. Right now I can go and say, wait a minute, who am I? Really, I'm no longer determined by all these little roles I played in society. I've got enough skills and talents behind me. I'm able to, you know, support myself or take care of myself enough here. Now, what can I really offer into the world? How can I be a provider of the feast of some unique spiritual talent I have? And what would that look like? And here's where you see men traveling or trying on going to Buddhist temple or trying a religious practice or spiritual practice, going to yoga, whatever it happens to be, changing their diet, to try to develop the sense of spiritual clarity and a way to help bring spirit into the world in that unique, almost creative way. And then finally, the evolved form of that co-creative man is the spiritually confident man.
I'm going to hold you right there because we're saving the best bit till last. We'll come back to the spiritually confident man in a moment. If you're listening to What Is Going On, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with psychology professor, counselor, philosopher of education, and author, Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, about his new book, The Spiritually Confident Man. Stay tuned.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, you know, your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, now we get into the best bit. So what does spiritually confident masculinity look like?
Good question. I spent a chapter of this in my book, but it permeates the entire book. And I think there's a certain, and it ties in with what we were talking about before we went into the break. A spiritually confident person doesn't make his markers, doesn't take and make his markers in the physical world. The physical world is a medium through which the spirit is expressed. And that has to be understood if someone is to understand what spiritual confidence means. In other words, I'm not going to become spiritually confident through a kind of 10-step enlightenment program. You know, it's that the spiritual confidence is basically another way of saying a trust in one's divine genes. I have a unique genius within myself that is not based upon inflation or my estimation, but is based on my expression, including sexual expression, spiritual expression, emotional expression and sharing, mental expression and sharing, all the different aspects of what it means to be human. And from a positive standpoint, not a negational standpoint. In other words, what is it that I actually present to the world that is going to help it in some way become more alive? And one of the chief sort of principles behind that is, and I discussed some of the principles of the spiritual confident man or this new masculinity, is to say, listen, I was given my life, right, as a bonus. And in thankfulness and in gratitude toward that life, I want to see what this life can do, what this person can do. Whether you believe in past lives or not, whether you believe in all the things that make us as human beings, cultural aspects and so forth, we can, I think, hopefully all agree that these things provide the paint for this painting that we're going to make with our life, this creative act that we're going to make. So the spiritually confident man, first and foremost, recognizes the gift of life given him and that he can never repay that back in 1,000 lifetimes. So he doesn't need to try. You know, that doesn't mean he sits on his butt and says, okay, everybody serve me. It's the opposite. He says, I'm getting up off my butt and I'm happy. I'm ecstatic to be given this chance. Yes, life is difficult. Yes, life can be painful. Yes, we oftentimes make it much harder on ourselves than we need to be. But in the end, let this challenge, let this difficulty bring us to this notion that we can offer something into the world, be a provider of the feast rather than a ruler on the throne, to enable others to be their highest selves rather than to sit on top of their heads trying to keep them down. And that is, I mean, this kind of brings it full circle to what the initial questions you asked, why I'm brought to this, why I asked my, you know, why I was saw myself as a misplaced man. Because I was brought into a world of masculinity that based my worth on competitive achievement over and above and against other people. And intuitively, and I think this is very key to the spiritually confident man and boy, intuitively that felt exactly opposite. That my worth should be heightened by my ability to help other people become their best people. You know, I shouldn't feel like down if someone else is exceeding me, especially if it's my child. I should be happy. I should have this notion that the generations are moving in a healthy direction, a vital direction, because they're exceeding me. And I can feel that I built part of that through my dedication of myself to creating better learning or faster learning or greater opportunity for the succeeding generation and better opportunity for women. You know, one of the examples I used in the example in the book regarding sexual harassment, I said, listen, you can take a man, and this is a nice concrete demonstration of a spiritually confident man versus a guy that's got a lot of work to do. Okay, you can take the same guy, all right, putting his hand on a woman's shoulder, okay, at work, wherever, okay, let's just say at work, okay, and that little extra ounce of pressure that communicates the intention of that man through that woman's shoulder will be the difference between sexual harassment and saying, I want you to be less than me. I want you to do something for me. You're an object for me. And the touch that's a providing touch for the energy and intention that comes through that hand is saying, I congratulate you. Wonderful job. I'm amazed by you. I'm even learning from you. Same exact action. There's no way to quantifiably tell the difference between the two of them. Just a little teeny extra ounce of pressure, perhaps. That's the only difference on the quantitative level. But it's worlds apart on the energetic level. And we got to get better at recognizing the energy of the situation and stop simply looking at behavior and the exterior appearance of the situation. The spiritually competent man wants his energy to generate well-being in the world, okay? And he takes the steps to do that in the way he treats people, and he treats himself. He's not going to inflate himself. He's not going to get down on himself. My teacher in second grade said, Zeus is too hard on himself. To give you an idea of me as a misplaced boy, struggling really hard to prove myself, so hard that the teacher is picking up on the fact that I need to relax instead of try so much harder in school. So that gives you, I mean, both the through that contrast, you get the notion of the cost of toxic masculinity, the cost of patriarchal masculinity, and the opportunities of spiritually confident masculinity. There is no real downside to spiritually confident masculinity. You are offering, you're learning, you're getting better, you're providing something into the world. You can even have an opportunity to lick your wounds and say, man, I'm just really tired, I'm blown away. This person I'm very close to died. You can express your emotions around that. You can have a community of people that you can welcome in. This is what it means to be spiritually confident, to recognize that your life runs beyond the boundaries of this world. And it is infused by the spirit as an actual energy and not simply as an idea or a belief.
So most fathers long for sons, most mothers love and want the very best for their sons. Both have an influence on the values they instill in their sons. So somewhere, mothers especially in the very early years have complete influence over their sons. Many women say they want to raise a man, you know, who isn't sexist, who is spiritually confident, even if they don't use those words, and it doesn't happen. So mm-hmm. What do we have to do? How can we raise our boys to become spiritually confident men? And how do we raise our girls to own their sovereignty, to be more independent and spiritually confident?
Well, I do address this in a chapter in my book, talking about raising spiritually confident men, or girls and boys. For girls, the path is a little bit clearer, I think. I put an example in there in which I was testifying at a Title IX conference for the inclusion of women and girls in athletics. That has been a huge, huge boon to the spiritually confident girl and woman, is this recognition that her physical power, her expression, her athleticism, you know, the expression of her power in the world is not only accepted, but actually appreciated and lauded, you know. Title IX did a lot to begin to change that dynamic. With boys, it kind of goes the opposite direction a little bit. They've had an entitlement and an overmastery of the world that is not really deserved. It was kind of created through this unequal system called patriarchy. So for a boy or man to be a little bit more critical-minded toward privilege, but not in a like shame-based way, to say, listen, how can I use whatever privilege I have or whatever power I have in the world to put it toward the aid of others and not to just simply self-promotion? And I did this. I show examples of this with my son. I call them the seven C's: critical-mindedness, community, courage, I think is in there, cosmic perspective, just showing you how the seven C's can help make a more well-rounded, spiritually confident boy. But the other aspect of it is, too, to allow for emotional sensitivity, not only allow it, but encourage it as an expression of power, not simply as an expression of weakness. We all know, even those that are loath to admit it, that to be spiritually and emotionally sensitive as a man takes a heck of a lot more courage, really, than to pull off some harebrained physical stunt that could actually get you seriously maimed and injured. And yet, you know, boys will, even in mild emotional sensitivity situation, men will run from that. When it comes to affection with other men, you know, gay or straight or bisexual, men are somewhat hesitant to express that publicly to other men. There's been a lot of training around men in terms and with boys in particular, in terms of expressing themselves emotionally and with affection. And a lot of it runs into things like pornography, the way in which sexuality, starting with male circumcision and race, being raised up through patriarchal objectification of women and using other people rather than providing and co-creating with them, that it ends up creating a kind of damning isolation for men. They can't really reach out. They can't really express themselves emotionally. And that's got to change. And it can change. And I think parents and societies and communities can begin to challenge that. One, by reading my book, because I put a lot of I go through a lot of the myths there. I go ahead and tear through many of those myths. But beginning to replace that with this kind of mutual respect and ability to listen, but at the same time to assert yourself. Well, I call it a high challenge, high support, right? It doesn't mean getting rid of challenge and everyone, let's all just get along. No, we're different people, and that difference is going to create clash and what I call constructive conflict. But at the same time, we need high support. We need people to have the resources and the coaching and the mentoring to do their unique thing instead of just trying to pound them into a role. This is where, you know, sensitivity training just doesn't work. Political correctness does not work. It just concentrates on behavior. It doesn't really get at the inside. And it usually is from a negative standpoint, don't do this, rather than from a positive standpoint saying, do this. And that's what we can do with our boys. You can say, do this. Go out with that girl, with that tomboy or whatever, you know,
yeah.
And enjoy yourself. You know, don't just say, girl stuff, you know, that sort of stuff.
One of the strands of dialogue that emerged after the Me Too movement was that many women were, you know, feeling empowered by this. But at the same time, now there was some kickback and they were saying, well, maybe we shouldn't dress in a certain way. Maybe we should hold back our sexuality. I mean, until women can be as openly expressive of themselves as they choose to be, in the same way that
right.
men can, we do not have that equality that we're looking for.
Absolutely. One of the greatest repressions to advancement of the human species is the repression of female sexual expression and social expression. That has got to change, and men and boys can have a lot to do with that. One of the things that I find very contradictory among many things in patriarchy is if men are so superior, supposedly, in terms of will and intelligence, you know, according to the patriarchy, then why are they so susceptible to so-called women's wiles? Like a woman shows a little skin that can't control
yes.
themselves. I'm like, no.
yeah.
That's demonstrating how little respect and discipline you have and how lowly the goals that you have for yourself have become, okay? Women should, and this, if there's something your audience can do, just briefly say, why not fully just appreciate a beautiful woman, okay? And like the expression of her, whether it's the way she dresses or the way she expresses herself, see, that's elegant, that's sexy, that's amazing, without trying to dominate it or possess it.
Yes.
And what, you know, don't, without adding, and what I could do with that, you know? But say, yeah. I just enjoy being in the presence of that energy. It makes me feel young, and I don't even have to have a relationship with that person, a romantic relationship with them. Just being around that person is making me feel young.
Yes.
If we can get to that point, we'll be well on our way. And if women can realize that they are not taking away from men, even though men will act in all kinds of odd and insecure ways when they are succeeding up and above men, when they are proving themselves to be smarter, men have got to get over that. I'm sorry. At a certain point, you got to stop enabling, you know, and women, you know, can say, listen, I'm not against you. You know, you can learn from me just as I learn from you. This is an opportunity. We're not in a competitive battle here. Let's work together to create something even bigger than the both of us. There's nothing
yes.
stopping us from doing that. Nothing at all.
Yeah. We're in this together, and I think it's time we realized it. We should be supporting each other to be our best. Things won't change
mm-hmm.
until we understand that you know, I becomes we, me becomes us. We're almost
mm-hmm.
out of time. Before we close, it's very clear that, you know, the egg has been cracked wide open. This is out there now. I mean, I'm thrilled that you've written this book. We need more platforms for conversation. We need to continue
mm-hmm.
the dialogues. Are you offering anything for men and women that allows them to continue this dialogue in a safe place?
I would say to start with, just contact me at my website, askdrzeus.com, and I will develop it. Ask me a question there in the contact form. if you have a depressing question about the dialogue between men and women, or an opportunity, or wish you have to start a certain kind of dialogue, please, even if it's just a couple lines, leave it with me. I'll start writing blogs about that. I'll start getting in contact and eventually begin to develop forums. I'm just starting myself. I said in the early chapter, the introduction, I said this goes beyond one man and one man's book. This is for a community of men and women, boys and girls to develop. But I would like to be an active member to helping to facilitate and catalyze that, to kind of be an enzyme for that. And I'm this book for me was my initial offering into a community to create the discussion, and I'm willing to actually expand that in the way that in discussing issues that are engaging people, and to begin to develop webinars and so forth as platforms where we can begin to discuss this explicitly and generously.
Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, we're out of time. Thank you so much. I heartily endorse your book. I encourage our readers, listeners, male and female, to get it. The Spiritually Confident Man, Pioneering a New Frontier of Co-Creative Masculinity by Dr. Zeus Yamayanis, is available on Amazon. It's published by Phoenix Transformation Media. For more information about his counseling services, courses, and to take a quick course or ask a question, visit askdrzeus.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.